The focus has been on this thawing of the relationship between North and South Korea.
The Olympics are underway in South Korea. It's Monday, February 12th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, volcanoes and earthquakes of fear in Asia. Mumbai brings schools to the street. We meet a top U.S. figure skater. Catching cold instead of gold. An ancient find uncovered. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The 23rd Winter Olympics opened Friday in the frigid South Korean city of Pyeongchang with some 3,000 athletes from all over the world competing for more than 100 gold medals in 15 sporting events until the close, February 25th. The games have been overshadowed by the thaw in relations between the Koreas that led to their joint athletic team and the doping scandal that resulted in the ban of the Russian Olympic Committee. Nearly 170 Russians are taking part in the games, but only as neutral Olympic athletes from Russia, as dozens of others waited late last week to hear if they would be allowed to compete after their appeal hearing before the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Steve Rausch is a sports performance expert with TSE Consulting, a Swiss-based firm with offices in Colorado Springs. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty South Korea is well prepared to host the games, and despite the cold, he said the venues are in fine shape.
As a host, I think very accommodating with very good feedback from the National Olympic Committees.
Some rather brutal weather conditions in Pyeongchang. Is that going to pose a problem?
You know, I think it is going to be one of those games where they absolutely have selected one that does have winter weather. They've taken some hits with Sochi and how warm it was and such that it was a challenge. And now I think they've kind of switched the rhetoric, and maybe they've gone too far the other direction with how cold the weather is. But I do think for the most part, athletes are prepared for the cold. I know the ticket sales are a bit of a challenge from what I'm reading, probably going to have a negative effect from a spectator standpoint, but I don't believe it will have an adverse effect for the athletic performance.
This brief thaw in relations between North and South Korea, is that a distraction?
You know, I think it can be. So many different media outlets that are there, they've got to write about something. The focus has been on this thawing of the relationship between North and South Korea.
Well, another distraction has been the banning of the entire Russian team over doping conspiracy. The IOC, the International Olympic Committee, now has opened a loophole to allow more than 160 so-called clean athletes back in, and now even more Russians are trying to force their way in through the legal appeals process. How big a deal is that?
It is a major distraction for those in the organizing committee. I think most of the other athletes are focused on themselves and what they're going to be able to do on the field of play.
What kind of performances do you expect? Who might shine?
You've got some incredible alpine skiers on Team USA that have the potential to really take home a lot of medals. You have some solid curlers. Hockey is just a bit of a crapshoot because of the NHL players not playing. Come down to Team USA, Canada on the women's hockey side. A big breakout maybe on biathlon for Team USA.
Steve Rausch said he expects the main competition for medals at the Pyeongchang Games to be among Norway, Germany, and the United States. So far in the early results, it looks pretty much like that. Germany holding the top medal standings with 3 golds and a bronze. The Netherlands follow with 2 gold and 5 total. Host South Korea, the United States, Norway, Austria, France, and Sweden each have a gold medal. The U.S. gold came from an unexpected win by 17-year-old Red Gerard in snowboarding slopestyle competition. He spoke with VOA just after his win.
I cannot believe it. I cannot believe it all worked out. I was just so happy to land a run and to make it on the podium. I'm ecstatic. I'm so excited.
With all of the more experienced Canadian competitors he faced, Gerard says he was asked what he thought his gold medal performance was in his first Olympic appearance.
They were all so excited. It was awesome. We're all friends out there. So, I think they were just really happy that we all landed runs.
And just after Gerard won, Chris Masder made history when he scored silver to claim the men's first Olympic luge medal of any kind in U.S. history. Follow Olympics highlights and other developments in Asia on Facebook at VOA Asia, also at our voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. North Korea's summit offer could test U.S.-South Korea's united nuclear front. Cambodia's ruling party to sweep Senate in election without opposition. Are Disney's Cambodian carbon credits a fantasy? Rare insider attack kills 16 Afghan intelligence operatives in Helmand. Pashtuns end protest in Islamabad, vow to reconvene if demands are not met. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Last month, the residents of Yangon, Myanmar's largest city, felt a strong bump in the night. Their national leaders in Naypyidaw, the country's thinly populated capital, were also stirred from their sleep. A magnitude 6.0 earthquake struck between the two cities in the early hours of January 12th. The Southeast Asian country is well accustomed to earth tremors, but there were fears that the catastrophe of a major earthquake would overwhelm Myanmar's already thinly stretched government and undo the fragile development of gains in recent years. A network of more than 30 seismic monitoring stations launched across Myanmar last year picks up 4 to 5 minor earthquakes each day, according to the Earth Observatory of Singapore, which worked on the project. Big ones, exceeding 7.0, hit roughly once a decade, according to seismic data of the past 170 years. The unpredictable nature of earthquakes and the lengthy intervals between major quakes pose some challenges to improving public awareness. A basic arrangement of ward-level assembly points and reinforced shelters stocked with provisions remains generally absent across Myanmar's towns and cities. Myanmar could be considered in or near the so-called Ring of Fire, a region known for major volcanic activity and earthquakes. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Charles Mandeville, a program coordinator at the U.S. Geological Survey Volcano Hazards Program. Melman asked if there's been an upturn in the number of volcanoes and earthquakes over the past few years.
No, Ira, this has typically been the pace of volcanic events in the past, and it may seem as though there's been an uptick, but in actuality, anywhere on the globe, in any given year, in any given week, we might have as many as 15 to 20 volcanoes that are in some state of unrest or escalating to eruption. And just as an idea for you to get your head around, we average about 1 to 2 eruptions a year in Alaska alone. Within the Pacific Ring of Fire, there's over 950 active volcanoes sticking out above sea level. So when you have that many volcanoes, the probability that you're going to see eruptive activity at some is going to increase just because of the nature of the number of active volcanoes that we're looking at.
You mentioned the Ring of Fire. Is that the most susceptible area of the world for volcanoes? And what about earthquakes?
Of course, it's because of the large number of active volcanoes there. It's very susceptible to volcanic activity. It's also the host of some of the world's largest magnitude earthquakes. I'm pretty sure on the order of 8 of the 12 largest earthquakes that we've had on Earth in historical times have actually been hosted on the Pacific Rim.
I've heard for years about the activity around Yellowstone National Park in the United States, in the western United States. There's another report I just read saying there has been seismic activity. Well, there always is around Yellowstone because of geysers and things, or resulting in geysers and things. But I've also read that there's a possibility of a huge supervolcano there at some point in history. What do you know about that?
Well, the last one occurred about 640,000 years ago, and the likelihood of another such eruption is actually quite low. It's actually in the 1 to you know, a few hundred million chances. The thing that is a possibility, though, in Yellowstone are some hydrothermal explosions, which are much smaller scale, but have occurred as recently as the 1890s and 1935.
And what is the possibility of that happening over the next year or so?
Probably, you know, maybe like a one in a few hundred chance.
What's happening in the Philippines with that volcano? It is spewed just a bit, but they're still keeping people far away.
Well, in other words, because you've got magma at the surface at Mount Mayon, and it's actually put up eruptive plumes up into the sky, it could continue in this kind of mode of eruption for, you know, several more weeks. And also, our job is really to get, and the, you know, job of the Philippine Volcano Observatory is to get people out of the way. So we can't stop volcano eruptions from happening, but what we can do is get people clear of the hazardous zones.
Dr. Charles Mandeville is program coordinator for the Volcano Hazards Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. Dr. Mandeville, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Ira. It's been a pleasure.
Happening now in Asia, the International Criminal Court is looking into Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's brutal war on drugs. Duterte spokesman told reporters Duterte sees an ICC examination as an opportunity to rebut allegations against him, adding the ICC move was a waste of time and resources. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's Monday morning. We're glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. In an unusual initiative, in a town bordering Mumbai in India, a school functions from a shipping container under a major overpass. The reason? The children on the street would not go to regular school, so authorities opened one where they would spend much of the day, out on the streets. It's from the streets of Mumbai where we hear more from Anjana Pasricha.
Students don their uniforms as soon as they arrive at this school in a remodeled shipping container placed under a busy traffic intersection in Thane, just outside Mumbai. These children of homeless parents had never attended school until one came to their doorstep, says Battu Sawant, who heads the voluntary group Samarth Bharat Vyaspit that runs the Signal School along with civic authorities.
People who live on the streets will not dress up their children and send them to school or pick them up in the afternoon. So it was necessary to bring the school to them.
Student numbers are up from 22 to 46 since the school began a year and a half ago. Earlier, these kids sold trinkets at the traffic signal or begged. Now they spend the day catching up with missed studies. Teacher Shraddha Dandavate says it was a challenge to make children who grew up coping with the rough and tumble of street life to give up habits like fighting and cursing and instead hold a pencil or learn reading.
They are not accustomed to school. They get bored and desperate to resume their earlier lives. But slowly, through stories, songs, playing, we get them used to spending the day in school.
The school has adapted to the lifestyle of the homeless. Because children sleep late, it opens at 10 a.m. when the incessant traffic noise dies down. It provides lockers to store books and uniforms that are not safe on the street, nutritious supplements, and teaches hygiene and grooming. But the transformation goes beyond appearances.
It ended begging. That helped change their mindset that you get things free just by asking. Education has taught them that you can work hard and have a good career.
Although a latecomer to school, the oldest student, 19-year-old Mohan Kale, is confident of cracking the grade 10 examination this year.
What to do in the world? How life should be lived? I have learned everything in school. That is why I like it here.
Ambitions and dreams are getting fired, like that of young Kiran Chandrakant Kale.
I will study very well and become an important man.
The Signal School is a small initiative in a country with an estimated 1 million street children. But hoping to usher in change one step at a time, Sawant has asked authorities for two more containers and a bus to ferry in children from other traffic intersections to join the school. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia. Hundreds of thousands of Hong Kong school children are getting an early start to their Lunar New Year holiday as the city's education authorities ordered the closure of all kindergartens and primary schools to help fight an outbreak of flu. You'll feel great when you visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Nathan Chen is a two-time U.S. national champion in men's singles figure skating. He is also the first international skater to compete in five quadruple jumps in his long program. As VOA Asia's David Byrd tells us, Chen is considered the top U.S. contender for a medal in this month's Olympic Games.
You could say that Nathan Chen has been getting ready for the Olympics his whole life. The 18-year-old youngest son of Chinese immigrants was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, and grew up in the shadow of the Olympic cauldron from the 2002 Winter Games. He fell in love with skating when his siblings took him to a public skating session when he was only 3 years old. Now Chen is a two-time U.S. national champion and one of only a handful of skaters worldwide who can land quadruple jumps. Chen's medal-winning long program at this year's U.S. Championships in San Jose, California, had five of them. Despite being in the spotlight, Nathan says he is not nervous or intimidated by the high-profile Olympic competition.
I think everything outside of the actual programs themselves will be very different, although I don't exactly know what that is yet. I'll see as it comes along. But as soon as I'm on the ice and doing the program that I'm planning out to do, it'll be the same as any other competition. It'll be the same as practice, and that's what I'm focusing on.
Nathan Chen also trained in ballet and gymnastics as a child. He says his early dance training gave him a foundation for his moves and often helped his work on the ice.
So being able to have that at a very young age definitely allowed me to come onto the ice and at least know where to put my arms, where to put my, how to move my body so that it, creates a line, how to dance to music. I think all of that definitely helped me as a kid and allowed me to adapt to different styles of skating from hip-hop to contemporary to very classical ballet as well.
The men's singles competition starts February 16th, and the gold medal will be awarded the next night, which also coincides with the celebration of the Chinese New Year. Nathan Chen says that he is proud to represent the United States as a Chinese American.
I'm very proud of myself for being able to go to the Olympics, represent Team USA as a Chinese American, and also Vincent Zhou is a Chinese American as well. So it's pretty big to have two, Chinese Americans compete in a men's event, which I don't think that's been done before. So in that in itself is a big honor, and honestly just really excited to get out there. I have to focus on myself before I even think about medals, so that's what I'll do right now.
Chen worked with another Chinese-American, award-winning designer Vera Wang, on his costumes. Wang had previously designed for several other Olympians, including Nancy Kerrigan, Michelle Kwan, and Evan Lysacek. Nathan Chen says he and Wang worked on costumes that would be both eye-catching and functional for his skating.
I gave her all of the ideas that I wanted. I wanted something, very contemporary, something modern, almost a little avant-garde, but also, very clean. So she brought out a whole bunch of different styles, and I kind of just picked maybe six or seven of her sketches that I really liked. We basically mocked up a couple costumes while I was there so that I could kind of see what it looks like on my body. And then, we just picked the best ones that we liked and took it from there.
To get on the podium, Chen will have to get past a field that includes 2014 Olympic champion Yuzuru Hanyu of Japan, two-time world and five-time European champion Javier Fernandez of Spain, 2014 Olympic silver medalist Patrick Chan of Canada, and 2017 European and Grand Prix final bronze medalist Mikhail Kolyada of Russia. The last American man to win gold in singles figure skating was Evan Lysacek in Vancouver in 2010. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
This news from VOA Asia. Thousands of Uyghur Muslims are currently being detained in cramped conditions at so-called political education camps in China's rest of far western region of Xinjiang. One recent news report put the number of Uyghurs confined at 120,000 in, quote, overcrowded and squalid conditions in just one prefecture of Xinjiang. Top stories and great features are waiting for you at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a norovirus that left officials at the Pyeongchang Olympics scrambling to contain it means athletes might have more to worry about than just going for the gold. More than 100 people have come down with this dreaded stomach bug. VOA's Carol Pearson tells us what it is, how it spreads, and what precautions athletes and others can take to keep the virus in check.
South Korean Olympic organizers quarantined more than 1,000 workers after some tested positive for the norovirus, a stomach bug that causes nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea.
Norovirus is a virus that's exceptionally contagious. It can be spread by simply touching surfaces.
And it can survive for days or even weeks on a variety of surfaces. It only takes a small amount of the virus to infect someone.
It can be spread by vomiting, and because it can aerosolize to some extent. People can pick up enough that way. It can be spread through the stool if you accidentally get a little bit of feces on something.
The virus spreads quickly between people, especially in close quarters like cruise ships and nursing homes. It can spread wherever there are crowds. The norovirus can also be passed on through contaminated food and water if the person handling it has the virus or gets fecal matter on the food or in a drink. Symptoms normally last for a few days, but afterwards it causes fatigue. The antidote is cleanliness, lots of hand washing and disinfecting any surfaces that might be contaminated, especially kitchens and bathrooms, and keeping your fingers away from your face. If all goes well, the athletes can just focus on their sports. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
We know the Olympics are deeply rooted in history, originating in ancient Greece, but let's go back a little bit further, like 100 million years. Recently in Egypt, a discovery was made. Faith Lapidus tells us about a new species of dinosaur found in western Egyptian deserts.
During the late Mesozoic period, this long-necked grazer wandered through what was then a coastal jungle. That's not what it was in 2013, when Dr. Hasham Salam and his team of graduate students began surveying the area.
So I told them to spread out so we can cover as much space as possible. And we found one of the team members started calling her colleagues, saying, I found a lot of bones. She even called me on the phone because I was about 2 kilometers away from her. And she told me, Doctor, there are a lot of bones. Come and see them. So I went, and I saw that it was a partial skeleton of a dinosaur. That, for us, was a very big thing.
The team carefully excavated the jawbones, leg bones, and other fossils and brought them to Mansoura University's Vertebrate Paleontology Center. The partial skeleton suggests the dinosaur's anatomy was similar to European giants of the same period, which counters theories that African dinosaurs were completely isolated during the late Mesozoic. Researchers hope more finds wait under the sand.
We know that for sure that these dinosaurs, of course, have something that eats them. As in any ecosystem, if we went to the jungle, we will find a lion and a giraffe. So we found the giraffe. Where's the lion? That is what we are going to look for now.
The giraffe has been named Mansourosaurus shahine after the team's university and one of the paleontology department's founders. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud, and we invite you to write to us. We'd love to hear from you. You can contact us via Facebook at VOA Asia or send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks go out to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer John Ellison, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.